Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates.
Greetings from Saturday morning. The soundtrack to this is provided by Ray. He's on the piano. So, right, Ray, I'm just talking about this week's podcast. He's trying to learn the Halloween theme, Michael Myers theme. He's coming on pretty well, actually. It's quite fun. So, we have reached the last episode of the series, which is exciting. It's been such a brilliant 10 again. I've had a lovely time, some amazing conversations, and I have finished the series with someone who I think, you know, when you see those women on TV and you're like, oh, I wish I had one of those people in my life. Well, I thought I would invite the original into my life, Dilly Carter. So I have been watching Sort Your Life Out with Stacey Solomon, the BBC show, for ages now. Actually really works on me. I like the way that they approach it. So what it is, it's a decluttering show. And we're not talking about people who've got like bits and bobs around the house. We're talking about people where the function of their daily lives is...
I'm going to get dressed.
All right, Ray.
You're leaving
now. Soon, yeah. Go and get dressed. It's all right.
You want to come and tell me, please?
Of course, darling. Absolutely. That's Ray. Off to get dressed. It's Saturday morning, just so you know. Yes. In the show, it's people whose daily function of their lives is completely prohibited by the amount of chaos and clutter that's their house. And sometimes it presents quite well. Like people might have, you know, their kitchen looks all right. But then when you start open cupboards and drawers, it's just madness in there. And then obviously some people where it's just rooms full of stuff piled up, things that aren't being dealt with, things they can't get rid of. You know, you might have a family where they've got quite grown-up kids and the parents have kept hold of everything since childhood. So the house is just overrun. People are often sleeping in weird ways as a result of all the stuff that's in the house. That kind of thing. Dilly is the woman who comes in and with a very calm, non-judgmental, practical, pragmatic view, she just says, right, let's make sure you keep all the stuff that makes you happy and works for you, and we get rid of the rest. So people today take all of the stuff out of the house, these people, put it all in a warehouse, lay it all out on the floor, categorize it, and then get rid of sometimes half, sometimes two-thirds of what they have. I would quite enjoy that. I'm not going to lie. There'd be things, I'd have weird categories. I have categories like majorette costumes from the 1950s, ice skater outfits, just, you know, random weirdness. I would keep all those things, just so you know. But yeah, it's a good show. And every time I've watched it, it makes me do a bit more. And I've now got a very good pile of things behind the sofa in the sitting room waiting to go to the charity shop. And I'm going to keep on going. I'm in one of those moods where I'm just getting rid of stuff. Anyway, so Dilly came around to see me. And what was extraordinary about Dilly, and you will hear it from her and she explains it very well, is I first wanted to speak to her because I loved her on the TV. And then as I got to know her through her Instagram, I realized there was so many more layers to this lady. From her childhood, she's born in Sri Lanka, adopted at 3 to a family here, Sri Lankan British dad, white British mother, and so raised in a family that was chaotic. You will hear about this, the home itself, lots of love, but definitely a tilted foundation in terms of how the home life was functioning. And she has a little girl who is 9, nearly 10. And in her quest to attempt to have another baby, she had several years of infertility and has now subsequently in the last 18 months found out some pretty shocking and probably quite devastating news about her health. But she is now on the other side and on the road to recovery. And actually, from where I stood, is brimming with good health. She actually one of those people that really radiates all the good stuff. But I won't say too much because Dilly explains it so well. But yeah, a really good chat. And plus, she's definitely kept me on the good path with the decluttering, which I really hope I stick to because Lord knows I need it. All right, see you in a minute. Well, it's so nice to meet you, Dilly.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming over. And when I first asked you to come to my house, my image was that I was going to have you arrive and then I was basically going to stage a sort of like seal you in so that you couldn't leave until my house was looking a bit more better. But such is your magic that actually I have found myself under a sort of spell of decluttering since I knew we were going to meet.
Oh.
So thank you. I've actually been really enjoying myself.
I love that. I love that you were under my spell.
Good way to start.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd have liked to have been locked in, but I mean, your house is insanely beautiful. And actually, it's one of those houses that instantly I felt at home when I walked in. But it's beautiful, it's eclectic, it's colourful, it's all the things that we should enjoy about our house. And although you said, you know, I've got lots of stuff, look at this, but it's always a collection of beautiful things. And I think that's the lesson that we always need to learn. It is, there's a difference between being a collector of something and having too much stuff and yes, having a lot of clutter. You know, your collection of things is beautifully organised, you know. And like you said, you know where everything is, you know, everything has a place, but it looks amazing, your house, so, you know.
Well,
no need to lock me in.
Yes, that would have been a horrible start for you to any sort of podcast chat. I can see that. But also, I'm beaming because basically you've provided me a lovely bit of audio that I'm going to reserve as a clip, standalone clip, to play to my family whenever they complain. Like an expert has said, look, it's a beautifully curated amount of things.
Yes, it absolutely is. It's beautifully and very tastefully done.
Thank you. Well, today is a good day, but I do think I'm constantly on the brink of, and sometimes do get overwhelmed by stuff. And does it surprise you how much people struggle with stuff generally?
I think so. It never ceases to amaze me how much stuff people do have, how much people buy. And, you know, people that live in studio flats or people that live in 15-bed mansions, it's incredible how much people spend on stuff. Yeah. And I think when you look at the show, that's why it's been so powerful, because seeing everybody's stuff laid out like that makes you think, if that was my house, what would we have the most of? You know, actually, that isn't that bad. We've got 25 chargers. We've got 200 pairs of shoes. We've got, you know, 3,000 bits of kids' artwork. We've got 200 soft toys. So you suddenly start looking at this and think, these people aren't that bad. So what it does is relate. And I think there's never been a show like it that doesn't make you feel more inclusive, more included, and actually this is most people. And I think more people are living in chaos, living with clutter, than aren't. And I think we just always think, don't we, we look at our friends, we imagine how our friends' houses are, or if we haven't been there, or how everyone else looks, you know, especially Instagram, social media. We think all these celebrities, oh my goodness, they must live in immaculate houses unless we see them, or they're living like this, they're living like that. And often or not, you only see a glimpse, don't you?
Yes.
We all see that glimpse. No one really sees their spare rooms. No one really sees where all the stuff is going. I mean, can you imagine how much stuff some of the, you know, high-end celebrity type Kim Kardashians, there is a garage somewhere with all the crap that they don't want, you know, that goes somewhere. And that's what we have to remember. You know, no one is perfect. Everyone lives in chaos in some way.
Yeah, Instagram that, Kim, if you're listening. I mean, I think... Well, you've actually hit the nail on the head about the show. So Sort Your Life Out is how I was introduced to you. And I love the programme. I've watched every episode. And you're right, because it's very non-judgmental.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a really brilliant thing that isn't actually at the heart of all those programmes that have gone before.
No.
Where people walk in and go, oh, how are you living like this?
Yeah.
It's very warm. It's kind of just saying, like, I can see as a family or as a couple or as an individual that you're starting to feel like you don't even know where to begin with this stuff.
Absolutely.
And it is how we're living. And there was an episode recently where a dad was saying, oh, I've bought like loads of these, but it's because sometimes I can't find one. So I just go like, and I go on my phone and I can just order another one and it's here tomorrow. And I've definitely done that. So I want to try and organise it so I actually know where stuff is.
Absolutely. And that's what most people do. You know, when you can't find something, you think, oh, I'll just buy another one. Because it's so easy, isn't it? It's so easy to buy something and it be here, if not by 10 tonight, by 10 a.m. tomorrow. That's scary. You know, we never used to be able to do that. We used to have to wait to want something. Think about music. You know, we had to wait to go to Woolworths, to go and buy a CD, wait for it to get there, to be in the top 10, be in the charts. And there was so much joy, wasn't there, with that?
Yeah.
Waiting for Saturday. And that was your weekend thing. You wait for your pocket money. You go to the store, you buy your CD, you buy your cassette, your vinyl, whatever it is, you saved up. But now everything is instant, and that's the problem. You know,
yeah,
as a consumer, it's become a problem for us, you know, and we're the ones suffering. You know, the companies are profiting. Look at Amazon, you know, look at, what's his name, Jeff Bezos, whatever his name is. You know, he's profiting. All the companies that are on Amazon, any shops, you know, it just, there's so much to be earned in products. Whereas before it wasn't, you know, it was much harder to buy things. And, you know, we didn't have as much disposable income. So we waited. And it was actually a joy, wasn't it, to wait?
I think as well, it's private. You can be private about your consumption.
Yes.
Because the thing you were talking about with music is the same with, as you say, everything else, where before to pledge allegiance or even mark interest in a band or an act meant that you had to go to the shop and request that song.
Mm.
And it was already, it was quite an active thing to go and say, right, I'm going to actually, you know, pay my money and own that song. Whereas now you can kind of dip your toe in things. But at home as well, I mean, I've definitely bought Jeff Bezos, like, I don't know, a couple of chairs on his yacht or whatever he's got. Because, yes. You know, you can just be, oh, yeah, I'll buy that. And oh, I'm not sure I need that, but oh, it's not that expensive. I'll quickly buy it again. And I think when I've been listening to you talk about decluttering, you were talking about sometimes the fact that you've had a financial transaction with something also means it can be quite hard to get rid of things because you'll think, oh, well, I've paid for that and it's still good for something. And what do I do with it anyway? So just store it.
That's the problem. Mm. And then there's a storage, isn't there? You know, some people have storage. It's not just their homes that have been turned into storage. It's actual excess storage. So many people have storage units full of stuff they just don't know what to do with.
Yeah.
And I often call our spare rooms, our lofts and our garages, places where decisions can't be made. That's the things where all the decisions we don't know what to do with go into that room. You know, what should we do with this guitar? I don't know. Let's put it in the spare room. What should we do with this hoverboard? I don't know. Put it in the spare room. What should we do with these clothes? I'm not sure about. Put it in the spare room. Put it in the loft. Put it in the garage. Oh, and actually, now we've run out of space there. Let's go and pay £1,000 a month for some storage unit.
Yeah.
How many people have a storage unit full of stuff that are just, it's just ticking over, ticking over, ticking over. By the time you get to that storage unit, you're like, why was I keeping all this? You know, what do I actually need to keep it for? So we have to try and have that same feeling about our lofts and garages. You know, really our garages should only be things like car related, sports related, you know, garden related, barbecue related. They're the things that should be in the garage. Not, you know, old furniture, you know, suitcases, things that don't belong, piles of clothes, bags, records, CDs. You know, these are things that don't belong in there. Mm. They're things that you can either sell or donate. So we have to learn to make decisions and be more ruthless. But we all struggle, whether it's emotional, whether it's financial, sentimental, what is it? You know, we struggle. So that's why they stay there.
It's so true. I love that the idea of these rooms where decisions can't be made. It's just like a kind of, oh, just put it in there. I've got cupboards, rooms, an attic, all that sort of thing that is exactly that.
Yeah.
And, you know, for anyone who hasn't seen Sort Your Life Out, so basically families, people empty their entire home, literally everything.
Every single thing.
Into a huge warehouse.
Yes.
Where it is then categorised and marked out with these beautiful neon bits of tapes. You can see it all laid out.
Yeah.
And there's always the moment where people walk in and see their life like that and they're like, is that really everything that was surrounding us for all that time?
Absolutely. It's
and
crazy.
It plays into a fantasy I've had for years where I imagine everything I own on a conveyor belt in front of me. That's the thing I've...
What was that game show?
Generation Game.
Yes.
So I imagine that. Like everything's gone. I'm like, oh, that's the head of that toy. And oh, that's where that went. And oh, golly, I didn't know I still had that. And that's the way I had it. So your show is the closest to that image of that. That's sort of like, oh, there it all is.
And what do you think you'd have the most of? What would be your biggest section?
Oh, golly. I mean, I'm a maximalist and I'm quite a happy shopper, it has to be said. I've got my mum's shopping gene. I mean, clothes has got to be way up there. Shoes, clothes. Also, I've sort of prided myself on keeping things for a really long time. I've even got makeup I bought as a teenager, Dilly. Runs quite fast.
Wow, okay.
The intervention might still need to occur.
We could do a celebrity Sort Your Life Out.
Yeah, you should.
Would you be happy to go on there?
Yeah, you know what? I'd be thrilled. However, I will know if they put some of these carefully curated items back in the wrong place. That you need a lot of bubble wrap. Because I specialise in buying things other people have decided they don't want anymore. Love vintage stuff, love secondhand. So a lot of it's fragile, broken, whatever you... But yeah, do it. I would happily sign up. I think whoever comes to pack up my stuff would have it like... They need to sit down for... I need some smelling salts for them. It's a lot of boxes.
So clothes is your problem?
It's definitely up there, yeah. Because if you like vintagey things, then you have this thing where you're like, well, I'm never going to see it again. It's now or never.
Yeah.
And I feel like sometimes I'm buying things for a version of myself that doesn't yet exist or an event I have not been invited to.
Just in case.
Just in case.
Just in case wardrobe, okay.
So if you ever have a fancy dress party coming up,
call
me.
You're the person.
I can probably sort you out.
Brilliant. Okay, so you're buying for things that you don't even know you might need.
But then sometimes I do, so
then you're grateful.
Problem. And I feel like you don't win any prizes for getting rid of something you later realise you needed.
No.
So.
But, you know, it's always down to space.
Yeah,
that's what you have to think. And that's what I'd always try and remind people. It's fine. Have a house full of stuff. Have a kitchen full of stuff. Have, you know, a playroom full of stuff. Have a garage, a loft, a storage room full of stuff. But if you haven't got the space, then why have you got that stuff? So if your wardrobes are overspilling, keep all those clothes. If your wardrobes are overspilling, then you haven't really got the space. If you have, then, you know, fine. If you've got 12 wardrobes full of clothes and you've got the space and none of those clothes are in your loft, none are in the garage, none have been stored anywhere else, then absolutely, it's fine to have a clothes addiction. But if they are overspilling...
Sorry, my body language has gone all small.
Then maybe, you know...
You already had a look upstairs, this is where this is coming from.
You need to
I think, as well, sometimes when I am going through my wardrobe, I feel a bit gross because I realise I've sort of... you know, given myself so many like spoils and I'm like, this is a bit gross really because you do have already like so many lovely things. You're not getting the full use. I genuinely feel like my cheeks have been quite red.
I'm interrogated. She's like,
Stop it.
God. This was a bad idea, this podcast, wasn't it?
But your relationship with decluttering goes back to your 20s, you said, is that right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, way before.
I suppose as a professional.
Yeah, as a professional, yeah. Doing it as a profession. And actually, it never was really a profession back when I started it. There was, you know, no one really knew what it was. Even now, it's still a new thing. People are still like, you do what? Go into people's houses and do what? Why would you do that? Sort of like, there's a job for that. People get paid for that. I'm like, yeah, some people get paid a lot of money for it. But yeah, I've been doing it since my 20s. You know, I used to spend every Sunday walking around all the wealthy estates, putting my flyers through doors, trying to get business going. I can organise your kitchen, your loft, your garage, or help you do your paperwork or whatever it is. And most people were connected to the admin side of it, thought, oh, okay, I get that. You know, I can be a PA. And so I sort of got my first job, and then word of mouth got another, then got another, and sort of built myself up from that. But in the interim, I had some other jobs going on at the side, and was, you know, until it really built. And then I got back with my husband and went to Australia, came back. And then I was like, right, this is what I definitely love. I need to keep doing it. It will take off one day, carry on just doing it. And then I think it was only about 6 years ago that I sort of transferred my business onto Instagram, you know, when it came, it might even be 8 years ago, who knows where time goes. And my friend was like, you need to get on Instagram. You know, that's where it is. I was like, Instagram, what's that? She's like, you should just, you know, talk about it. You're quite good at talking about what you do. Just tell people what you do and why you do it. And so I went on Instagram and just started talking about why we declutter, the importance of it. And it just grew from there. And then it wasn't till 2020 that the TV show found me. And then things just changed completely. So it just went from being great to being amazing.
But also your instinct is amazing, because actually, as you said, like, so 20 years ago, it wasn't really such a big thing, but now it's huge. Yeah. People are obsessed with
organizing.
And, you know, you have, I suppose, this side of the pond, it's Sort Your Life Out. In America, it's the home edit.
Yes, yeah.
We've obviously got Marie Kondo and all that she's done with. I mean, I went to see her do a talk once. Completely extraordinary.
Oh,
my
wow.
friend had a spare ticket, and she doesn't speak any English, so she had a translator.
Yeah.
And there was a bit where she folded a pair of socks so that they stood up on their own and the whole room clapped. And I was like, I don't really know where I am. This is a weird world. It was quite extraordinary.
I love that. They
it was really funny.
I'm like, yes.
Oh, yay for socks, standing up on their own in that little foldy way. But her, in a way, I think her style of decluttering felt very, still quite prescriptive. I know she talked about finding the joy, but I felt like you sort of want, it was almost like you're doing it to make Marie Kondo happy with what you've done.
Yes.
But I think where your heart seems to be, and no disservice to her, because obviously she was helped a lot of people too.
She's put everyone on a platform. Absolutely. Yes. She's opened up the industry incredibly.
But I think with your thing, it seems to be more like, because I think, so I'm just thinking, if I talk to you next about your mum, because I feel like that's such a big keystone in the story of your relationship with your job.
Yeah.
But I also really want to talk about your daughter, because your little girl's about to be 10. I think I'll talk about that first, because I want to know, it's such an obvious question, but children bring with them, first of all, their own personalities, but also things, quite a lot of stuff.
Yes.
So when you had your baby nearly 10 years ago, how did you feel about the influx of new things that come with that?
It was really interesting, actually, because, you know, we've never had a house full of a huge amount of stuff. Both me and my husband are really ruthless. So, you know, it's rubbed off on him. Yeah, really handy. We're both very good at spending. We both love lovely things.
What's your weakness then, Dylan?
Trainers.
Okay, cool.
But I'm still good at, like, having my, you know, curated. I laugh because I say it's curated. I've probably got a lot more trainers than most. And I'm going to a trainer convention on Saturday. And
you
I'm like,
to a trainer convention?
Yeah. I love a good pair of trainers.
Do you put, like, spare ones in your bag to, like, change into every hour?
Yeah, that's it, because I don't want to get them too creased.
Oh, it's too much pressure on the one pair you wear to a trainer convention.
I know. As soon as I got these tickets or got invited to this event, I was like, me and my husband both like, what are you going to wear? He's like, I don't know, what are you going to wear?
Heels.
He's, yeah. He's like, well, obviously I've got to wear these.
Anything
and I was like,
trainers.
Ooh,
wellies.
It's so
I'll go
funny.
Down a storm. You'll be the only one in the room.
Oh, can you imagine? Get talked about. Be great. But no, I think that's probably my weakness is trainers. You know, I find it hard to look at them and think, oh, what am I going to switch over? You know, if something comes in, something should leave really, but which ones do I like the least? And so that's probably my weakness. But everything else, but even then, if someone told me you can only have one pair of trainers, I'd be like, okay, whatever. Mm. So I'm not emotionally attached to anything. So if my, and this sounds really harsh, but I always think if my house were to burn down tomorrow,
yeah,
and everything in it, what would I save? And I wouldn't care about any of it. You know, all that would matter would be my family,
yeah,
my dog and safety. You know, we should never be emotionally attached to anything. You know, there might be some things I think, oh, that's a bit sad that went. But even in my house, when I look around now, there's nothing that I need. You know, I've got everything I need in my people. So I don't need it in stuff. So even jewellery, I'm like, whatever. doesn't matter if it goes. Mm. So, I just have never been that sentimentally attached to anything. So with my daughter, when things came in, you know, we'd buy her stuff, you know, of course, we'd spoil her. She was our first child. Get whatever you want. Yeah, you can have this, you can have that. But everything was beautifully organised, of course, and everything was limited. So, you know, for the space that she had. I mean, there was probably one period, I'd say, when she was 6, 7, when there was an LOL obsession.
Oh, yeah, and funny, those
that
adults,
was
aren't they?
That was probably the hardest for me, because that was, oh, my gosh. There was, at the time, it was LOL and Barbies at the same time. So I had a Barbie house, 2 LOL houses, 1,000 LOLs. It was just, I walked into
a
room.
You're talking in past tense. Does she not have any of this stuff?
No. No,
have
it's all gone.
That by the age of 9?
Yeah, she's gone out of that now. So now she's very like, she's almost like a teenager. My husband's a bit not happy with that, because she suddenly went from everything pink to now I want everything white. White bedroom, white walls, pink this. She's on her iPad and she likes drawing. So she's got a little arts and crafts corner. And that's it. She's the LOL obsession stopped. And she's very like me. She's very good. Like, we're having a clear out. Okay, what are we getting rid of? You go through your bedroom. And she's not allowed to get anything new until she gets rid of something.
Oh, that's clever.
So I've taught her that from a really young age. And also, she's not allowed to get anything unless she refolds her T-shirts, or she sorts out her drawers, or she rehangs her wardrobe. So she has to, in order for me to want to buy her something, she has to do something.
Does she get scared when Christmas is coming?
Yeah. I mean, that's the only time. Yeah, yeah. That's the only time she can get without asking. But because kids want everything all the time. And, you know, she can have things. And I think that's the problem, isn't it, in this day and age, when, you know, we can all buy our kids whatever they want mostly, can't we? And it's nothing, it's not a treat anymore as much. So that's why I have to make her work for it or earn it. Or it's not just a given that, yeah, you want something, you can have it. Because I don't want her to grow up thinking that you can have everything you want with no type of lesson. I think, you know, it's important for her to realise that, you know, things don't just get handed to you easily. So if you do have it, you have to work for it. You know, we've had to work hard to get everything we want in our life. So why shouldn't you, in terms of, you also have to realise that money doesn't grow on trees.
Yeah.
So, you know, mummy and daddy work all the time to make sure that you can have all these lovely things, but you have to appreciate them.
Mm.
So, you know, one in, one out. You know, if you want a new pair of jeans, great. Let's see what you've got in your wardrobe that can go. You want a new jumper, you want a new hoodie. And the thing is, kids' clothes, the things they want nowadays, you know, they're not like 10 quid. They're like 50, 60 quid hoodies. Uh-huh. Or they're like a pair of Nike Pro leggings, which are 30 quid. So it's not cheap. You know, you're buying 5 of them. It soon adds up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
So I think, you know, it sounds like I'm really harsh, but I'm a bit like, yeah, you can do it. If you want it, I'll buy it for you. Go and sort your room out. You know, you've got to keep on top of things. You've got to do it. And she will. She'll go. She'll go, I've done it. I've redone my whole room. And she's literally refolded all her socks, organised her underwear, you know, refolded her hoodies. And she, you know, she does it really well. And she loves it. So, you know, it works.
I think that's absolutely brilliant.
Keeps it to a minimal.
I thought the intervention was about my clothes, but I think it's actually about the relationship I've encouraged my kids to have with stuff, probably. Because I think there's so much value in all of that. And the idea of her actually appreciating and having a relationship with what goes on in the transaction of actually getting something.
Yeah.
Whereas I think sometimes with kids, you don't talk to them about that because it kind of goes over their head, but you can always instill an idea of value, even if it's not directly, you know, something like an abstract notion of money.
Yeah.
But they can understand about your time, about your work, about all these things. Yeah. As they get older, it just becomes part of the fabric.
Exactly.
Of how they think of things.
Yeah, they just have to realise that, you know, yes, you can have these things. And of course we want to buy you these things, but it doesn't come without something because, you know, I've had to work 5 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, 15 hours that day in order to give you that thing or to put towards that thing. You know, we both work hard. We're both working parents all the time. So it doesn't just get given to you. So what are you going to do if you want something new? Because what I want her to do is I want her to work like I did, have a part-time job, go to college, go to university. I don't want her to think that she can't do anything for the rest of her life and she's just going to, you know, get a job and do this and, you know, I don't know. I want her to realise the value of money because I think kids don't realise the value of money anymore. I think, you know, it's really hard, isn't it, to instil, like you said, good lessons to them, to teach them about the value of things. And, you know, we even with the show, you know, it's showing, look at what the show teaches children. You have got 3,000 toys. you know, and when they get asked to choose their toys they want, what do they choose? A handful. Because it's too much. It's overwhelming. So it's great to have loads of things, but A, have the space for it. B, know the value of it. And C, know that it's not just going to, a given that you're going to get more of it. So it's about just thinking, okay, do you know what? We need to start changing the way that we buy our children toys. We need to make sure that, you know, they're only going to get this. They will get it, but, you know, you've got to do something for it. Or you have to at least realise that there is some sort of value to it. It's not just a, here's all your Christmas presents.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And I think more and more now, especially in the last few years, we're trying to teach children about experiences, aren't we? Mm. More about giving experiences rather than gifts. Or you have one really big expensive present at Christmas rather than 30 small ones. You know, okay, you want a new iPad, you want a new laptop, you want this or you want that. That's a huge amount of money. If you're going to get that, then you're only getting something smaller. Mm. Whereas before, you know, especially as we were, you know, in my younger years, it was all about quantity, all about volume, wasn't it? How many presents you can fit under the tree. And people spend excessive amounts on their children at Christmas. You know, people have like 30 presents each on their kids at Christmas. And you're like, oh my God, you know, and most of it is just too, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's just stuff that you're like, oh, it's like McDonald's toy level. You're like, oh, God, you know, that's the first thing you clear. Same with us and fast fashion. You know, the first things we get out of our wardrobe are the things that cost the least. So if we were to go and have a wardrobe clear out, the things that you're going to get rid of and chuck in the black bag are all the things that cost the less. The things that you've invested money in, the things that you've really saved up to get, the things that you really cherish, you know, the vintage jacket you found that actually it was a one-off, they're the things you're never, ever going to throw out. But the things that you've just bought from Zara, the things that you bought from the high street, things you bought from ASOS, all of those places that are cheap, fast fashion, well, you know, they're the ones that will go quickly because they're the lesser. They're the ones that you don't care about. And it's the same with the kids' toys. You know, the really good quality things, the things that are lovely, the things that last, the things that stand the test of time, they're the ones that stay. Yeah. But the other ones that are cheap just end up getting put in a bin.
It's so true. And as I'm listening to you, everything you're saying is very sensible. And I keep thinking about the fact that your childhood, from as I understand it, was very different. So you're like the first new generation of raising your kid the way you are, because it sounds like how you started out was very different.
Mm.
So as I understand, you were adopted when you were only 3.
Yes, yeah.
And then your mum had quite a chaotic home. Mm-hmm. She suffered with bipolar and it was quite a turbulent childhood, like lots of love, but quite a lot of chaos around you.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I suppose what your memories of all of that and how where are the similarities maybe with how you're raising your daughter?
I think the similarities with my daughter are definitely, so my mum and dad, I spent very little time with them growing up. So I never had a lot. We never celebrated Christmas because they were so busy. So they barely put up a Christmas tree. You might get one or two presents at Christmas. So that's why I was always very quality over quantity growing up. And actually from a very young age, which I thank my mum for, was that it was very much quality over quantity. So I was always the one at school that had the first of everything, you know, but I had the most expensive things. I was the first one to have a mobile phone, first one to shop in Oasis, first one to go to Karen Millen. I always had the best of everything, but I only went shopping a couple of times a year. So my mum would take me once every few months or once every 6 months, and my dad would take me to Topshop in Oxford Street, and he'd sit there on his briefcase, fall asleep, give me his card and go, buy whatever you want. But it was only once a year he'd do that.
Mm.
So I'd sort of buy seasonal, you know, or like buy in big chunks and then not again for months and months and months. So everything had to last. Everything had to be quality. Everything was, you know, not every week. So that's sort of how I was brought up, because they didn't enjoy shopping. They didn't go out shopping much. So when they did, they'd buy me really lovely stuff. So my mum was always like, no, let's buy quality stuff, but we'll buy less of it and we don't go as much. So I always had that in me to be like, no, I'd rather buy you the good things that are going to last longer. Don't want to have to buy you a new pair of school shoes every month because they're falling apart. Let's buy some really good ones. And then my house was just, you know, like I said, because they worked so much, the house was just a mess. They didn't care about the house. You know, in the whole time I lived in that house till I was 18 and moved out, they never decorated. So it was the same hideous orange 60s wallpaper that was when they first moved in. They never did anything to it. The only room that ever changed was mine, because I was like, oh, I didn't like this. I didn't like the mess. You know, their room was horribly messy, and mine never was. You know, the rest of the house wasn't awful, but like the kitchen was always a bit messy, but it was the only place my dad said had to be clean by the end of each day. He's like, you know, the surfaces have to be clean before we go to bed. And I'm the same. Unless I've been up having a drink with friends and we've had a party, you know, the kitchen's always clean before we go to bed. So I had lots that I learned from my parents in terms of what I liked and what I didn't like, the chaos that I liked and the chaos that I didn't like. So I feel like growing up, it was all chaos in my house, because it was just, there was so much going on all the time and they were always busy. But the reason I realised I loved organising was because my mum and dad weren't there much. So my neighbours ended up looking after me half the time, because they wouldn't get back to work till like 11, 12 at night. And my way of saying thank you to them, because they'd never take any money and they would never take anything off my parents, was to help them tidy up. So I'd be like, oh, let me help you hoover, let me help you tidy, let me help you organise, let me do anything I can. So I used to get a lot of fulfilment out of that, because it was my way of saying thank you to them. And that just grew that love of, you know, let me help you, oh, you sorting out your wardrobe, let me have a little look, let me help you with you. So I really enjoyed that. But, you know, the chaos at my mum and dad's house was the calm across the road. So that was almost my escape. So their home was always just like, everything was beautiful, Laura Ashley. Everything was immaculately placed. It was just this most beautiful organised kitchen. Everything had a place. They, you know, they had a utility room, which was quite trendy back then, you know, which we didn't have then. I didn't have that in my house. Everything just had a place and it was right, whereas my home was chaotic. So I'd always escaped to that house. And that was my calm. And I realised that this is what I love. This is what I want when I grow up. You know, I want my house to be like this. Mm. I don't like what this is. And then my mum, because they did work so hard, ended up getting worked into the ground. And that is what caused her mental illness. So my mum worked for my dad, who was a chartered accountant. She was his bookkeeper. And it just, I blame him for the way that her illness went, because I think if she hadn't worked so hard, she wouldn't have ended up where she was. And I think the bipolar was an effect of that, of just not ever having any time to themselves. Like I said, they had no social life. They barely had friends around. They just worked till 11, 12 at night every day. And then, like I said, barely put a Christmas tree up, didn't decorate, didn't have any time to themselves. And it just was, I feel like it's a miserable existence. And so when I was 11, that's when she had her serious breakdown, and then she then was sectioned nearly 10 times in the next 10 years, in and out of mental institutes my whole, you know, from I think it was 10, 11 to into my 20s. And it was sad, really. I just felt sad because, you know, it was, I just think it, that's why it's so important to live your life, you know, not work yourself into the ground, get that work-life balance, because it's so easy, isn't it, to let life completely overtake you, but then let it overtake you so much that your house is becoming detriment to that. Your relationships are becoming affected by that.
Mm.
And I think I say on repeat, when clutter starts affecting your relationships, that's when you have to know that something has to change. So when your kids can't eat at the dinner table, when they can't find a clean pair of pants in the morning, you know, when you're not able to get yourself dressed, when you're trying to get through clothes to get into your bedroom, to get into your bed, you know, that's when things have to change. And I think that's a really harsh reality of it. But in my second book, my opening line or the first few sentences was, my mum, who now lives in the bottom of my garden, in a house in the bottom of my garden. My mum, who lives in a granny annex at the bottom of my garden, not in a little hut. You know, my mum is a constant reminder of the life I don't want. So, you know, every time I walk down my stairs and come into my kitchen, my mum's at the bottom of my garden. And I just think it's a really sad reality of that's where she's ended up. You know, I care for her now. She has carers as well, because her mental health is that, you know, I can't look after her full time and look after me. You know, I tried to do that and it was just too much. You know, it's a lot to look after someone. And, you know, I've got such admiration for carers and what they do and how hard they work. But unfortunately, you know, years later, my dad then died and my mum was on her own and her house just went into disarray.
Yeah.
And after I'd got married, I remember going and visiting her and the house was just, it was just beyond anything it had ever been before as I was growing up. And I just thought, well, I'm in a position to help. So I helped her very quickly over a weekend, turned her house around. And I was just like, this is so what I've been born to do. I know this is definitely my calling. It isn't just I can help my mum, I can help other people do this. Because I walked into her house and I don't see anything but the end goal. I knew my mum's house was lovely. The bones of the house was lovely. I knew that she didn't know what to do with it and she didn't know where to start. But I could just go in and go, right, this is what we need to do. This is how to do it. You sit down, make a cup of tea, lead me to it. And that was it. And I did it, turned it around, made the house look beautiful. And I think that's when I came on Instagram, actually, because they were the first pictures I posted in my mum's before and afters of her house. And said, you know, this is what I can do. This is how to do it. You know, don't be overwhelmed by it. You know, book my services. I'll come in. You know, there's no judgment because I've watched my mum go through this. And, you know, all I know is that I can make it better. And I think that's always been my goal in any situation. And even now, you know, when I do the courses that I do and I teach people, I'm always like, it's never a judgment. You just have to make people realise and make them feel at ease and comfortable that, you know, everyone gets into these situations, whether it's mental health, whether it's sickness, whether it's disability, whether it's, you know, break up a marriage, whether it's just general life, you know, but it's just, you can get out of it.
Yeah. And as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking there must have been such a tangle of emotions for you when you, you know, newly into double figures. And I'm sorry to see that happen to your mum over and over, because that's a very adult backdrop to childhood when you're still little yourself. And it means you have to often be the grown-up one when everything is like that. And I suppose you're keeping everything ordered around your daughter is like a constant message to her. I've got this.
Yeah,
isn't it? Over and over, I've got this, because you know what it's like to be that child looking wide-eyed, thinking, I don't know where my stuff is. I don't know how to get myself. Yeah, I have to sort this out. No one's coming to sweep in and make this better.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, it's just me and my dad. Yeah. And most of the time, my dad was useless. You know, my dad was a very typical Sri Lankan man. And I say that, you know, with care about other Sri Lankan men. But, you know, in my dad's age, my dad was in his 50s when they adopted me. So he's a lot older. And then, you know, by the time I was in my by the time I was 10 years old, he was in his 60s. And then, you know, he was an older dad. And so he'd been brought up the woman does everything and that's it. So, you know, he barely made a piece of, you know, the only thing he'd ever do was make toast. So everything was done for him. You know, he didn't ever do anything to do with the house. So when my mum was ill and in and out of hospital for weeks and months on end, no one was looking after the house. It was just me and him. So, you know, he didn't care. Yeah. He didn't know what to do. So that's why, you know, I spent half the time at my neighbours and, you know, very little time at my house, because, you know, they were looking after me. They were caring for me, because my dad just didn't know how to. Didn't even ever learn how to do anything with the house. He didn't have a clue about what he was meant to do. So, you know, we sort of muddled through. So I think that's why my daughter is so stable. You know, she's such a confident, lovely little girl, and she knows where all her stuff is. She, you know, like, this morning, she gets herself up. She's got an alarm at 6:30. She sort of wakes up, has a doze, gets out of bed, gets herself showered, gets herself dressed. She makes her own packed lunches. You know, she's such an older 9 to 10 year old. You know, she's very advanced, but you know, she's had to be because I've been working full time as well. So me and my husband have always been like, no, you can do it. You know, we've never mollycoddled her, although she's been very loved and she's got a huge amount of love and she's a very happy child. You know, she's never will moan about getting up at 6 a.m. because I've got to go to work and she's got to go to my neighbours. You know, I'm like, right, tomorrow morning, you're up at 6, you've got to go next door. You know, Chris is going to come over and look after you. Then you've got to go to Kirsty's at 8. She's like, yeah, okay, no problem. Just sets her alarm, gets up, gets on with it. You know, always a smile on her face, never miserable. But I think that's just because that's the way I've had to be. And, you know, when you work full time and you've got so much going on, they have to adapt to your life. And I always wanted to make sure that when we had a child, that was going to be the case, that, you know, they are just going to naturally fit into our lives, not like, oh my God, my whole life has to stop and now everything has to change. And I know some people it does change and, you know, that's fine as well. But I think when you're sort of on a path and you know that no one else is going to support you apart from yourself, you have no other choice, do you? We're not from an affluent family. We haven't got affluent parents. My mum and dad didn't have money. But, you know, they had money when I was young. They were chartered accountants, so, you know, they earned good money. But my dad was a terrible businessman, so he never really got loads of money that he should have got, you know. And in the end, he had to sell the house to pay off a load of debt and move to the West Country. And that's when it got even worse, you know, my mum's mental health, because, you know, they'd done all this work for what? Nothing. Mm. So that's why I'm very much like, buy the dress, buy the shoes, buy it. Because, you know, my dad never got the car he probably wanted, never had the holidays that he might have wanted. Whereas now we're like, right, I've earned some good money. Let's go on a nice holiday. Let's buy a piece of nice jewellery. Let's do this. Let's do that. Because it can all be gone tomorrow, you know. My dad died early when I was 30. Charlie's mum died when he was 30. So we both had loss in our lives. So we're both very much like, live your best life. Because no one knows when it's going to go.
Well, I think it's... I mean, I'm hearing you talk has made my heart go out to any kid that grows up in that kind of chaos. I think that's a really sad idea of being in a home that just has got such a manifestation of, I don't know what the word is, being destabilized, I suppose. Mm. Like instability, wonkiness, just that feeling like, you know, that even when you're little, you just know this isn't quite right. It's not quite right how close to the brink we are, and it's all just hanging together. But also it's so amazing that through all of that you've made such a map for yourself of the kind of parent you wanted to be. Mm. Because you clearly have got such an idea of like the values that really mattered, but also how to actually what they would actually look like in a practical sense. So I suppose your pragmatism runs in all directions with your emotions as well as your work. But you have had to experience quite big things that you've had to deal with your emotional and your health in the last little while. And I suppose if you're comfortable to, it would be amazing to talk about what's happened to you recently. Because when I was looking, firstly, I just knew about your amazing skills with the decluttering. But then the further I got into your story, and actually in your Instagram, you've talked a lot about your secondary infertility, but your recent health things have sort of only really surfaced relatively recently.
Mm.
But you've been through an awful lot, Dilly.
Yeah, it's only recently surfaced. I only talked about it, you know, I think a couple of months ago I came out saying it, because I'm very much I don't think you can talk about something unless you've been through it. You know, I've always been very practical like that. You know, I can't teach people unless I've done it myself. I can't talk about a hotel unless I've been there myself. I can't eat something unless I've been there myself. So for me, getting that diagnosis, it was like, and like I said right at the beginning of this conversation, I don't know if it was before we even started this, I've always been very, never woe is me, but how can I make the best of the situation? Mm. You know, how can I learn from it? How can I go forwards? I don't wallow in very much at all. So if something happens, I'm like, okay, it's happened. Let's see how we can get through this. And I think it's always fight or flight, isn't it, when something like that happens? So, yeah, the story, you know, basically was that we were trying to get pregnant for, well, 8-9 years now and wasn't getting pregnant. I struggled with fibroids for years and years. fibroids, something inside you that, like, you know, around your uterus, your womb, that grow, they shrink, they grow, they shrink. And, you know, the NHS don't deem them as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just like, oh, you know, they grow, they shrink, they're fine, they're not affecting your fertility.
That's a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'd had this fibroid last year in my stomach. It was growing and growing. It was like 12 centimetres. It was sticking out my stomach. Gone to the doctors. Oh, you know, it's quite pain. Like, I've got this big lump sticking out of my stomach and, you know, it's causing me a bit of aggro and, you know, I'm really bleeding a lot and all of this. Yeah, but there's nothing we can do, really. We'll put you on the waiting list for 2 years. But if you can afford it, why don't you go private? I'm like, could do, but, you know, do I want to go and spend 12 and a half grand? I don't know. But anyway, I'd had this huge bleed. I was in the middle of filming. I had to be rushed to hospital. They were like, no, there's nothing wrong with you. You've just got a heavy period. Fine. Okay. Anyway, I was fed up with it and I'd spoken to my manager and I was like, look, do you know what? I'm just so fed up. She's like, well, why don't you speak to the Gynae Geek? The Gynae Geek is this amazing woman on Instagram who's a gynecologist and she's also a friend of my manager's. Just have a conversation with her. I thought, right, okay, I'll have a conversation with her. I said, look, this is my history. These are my problems. She said, go and see a specialist. If you've got the money, go and see a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why wouldn't you invest in your health? You know, there's a huge amount of problem and you want to get pregnant. So what else can you do? So I said, okay. Went and saw her friend who was a surgeon and a specialist, a gynae specialist, one of the best in this country. He scanned me there and then. In private appointments, you always get scanned straight away. And he said, see that black mass inside your womb? He said, that is the fibroid taking up your whole womb. So where the NHS have told you that the fibroid is on the outside of your womb, it's actually on the inside. So no wonder you're not getting pregnant, there's no space, and, you know, that's obviously causing you a huge amount of stress, and, you know, there are probably lots of reasons why you're not getting pregnant, but the first is, let's get this out, and I can do it next Tuesday. And I was like, oh, my God, okay. And, you know, it's going to cost 12 and a half grand. I was like, okay. All right. So I went home and we sort of had this discussion, you know, we're in our 40s, this is our last chance. Do we get the driveway done? Do I go and get my fibroids out? You know, what should we do with this money? You know, what should we spend first? And we're like, do you know what? Let's get this done. You know, your health isn't important.
Yeah.
So
that is the right decision. That
was right decision.
I'm sure the driveway can survive for a little bit longer.
But, you know, sometimes you have these weird, don't you think? You sit there and have these conversations.
Also, put into the equation, shock. You're in shock at this conversation you've had from this one scan that's basically completely reversed everything you thought that was going on inside you.
Yeah.
And all these dismissive people.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, we do have the worst gender pay, the health pay gap. In this country is the worst in Europe, by the way. So it's investment in men's health, women's health. That's why I said there's a whole other conversation
exactly
around how things like fibroids are talked about. But anyway,
absolutely, yeah. So I just was like, oh, do you know what? This is so important. Let's do it. We want to have a baby. Yeah. Let's do it. Okay. 2 weeks later, go and have my fibroids out. Recover. Obviously, wake up from the surgery. The surgeon is walking around doing his rounds, and he said, you know, the surgery went really well. We didn't just find one fibroid, but we found 12. There were 12 fibroids inside your womb, he said, I'm going to be really honest with you. Your womb was severely damaged. You've got something called adenomyosis. He said, so I wouldn't be surprised if you see me in a month for a hysterectomy. And I thought, oh, my gosh, it's a bit harsh. I've just come here for, you know, you're meant to be removing these. Because in my head, I was already thinking, well, I'll just get over this. In 6 months, you have to let your womb heal after you've had this myomectomy, it's called. A myomectomy is where they remove the fibroids that are large. So it's like a C-section.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd had a C-section basically to remove these fibroids because they were so big. And he said, I think you'll see me in a month for a hysterectomy. And I was like, oh, God, okay. I'm thinking in my head, well, let my womb heal for 6 months. And then in 6 months, I can start IVF or whatever it is that I need to do to get pregnant. Anyway, 2 weeks after the surgery, I was feeling fine. I was up and about, walking about. I even started filming. I was like, do you know what? I can go back filming. They were like, don't rush back. I was like, no, it's fine. I can do my warehouse scene. I'll just walk gingerly. I won't pick up anything, won't lift anything. Started filming. Doctor rang me. I need you to come in. You have to have your post-op checkup. And I said, okay, I will. I'm filming. He said, I really need you to come in. And will your husband be coming with you? I was like, I wonder why he's asking that. I thought, oh, because I'm not meant to be driving. Thought he wants to make sure Charlie's going to drive. I was like, yeah, we'll be in. Anyway, went in on the Friday. He's like, Mr. and Mrs. Carr to come and sit down. And I was like, why is he being so miserable? And he sat down and he said, you know, obviously, as you know, with every operation, anything that's taken out of your body gets sent off for testing. And I was thinking, yes. But actually in my head, I was thinking, oh, I didn't even think that far. I just thought, oh, just having those removed and off we go. Mm. And he said, and I'm really sorry to say that the fibroids that we removed were all cancerous. And he said, you've got stage 1 cancer of your womb. I was like, so obviously we just sat there like, oh my God, you know,
yeah,
in complete shock. And so he said, so what that now means is you have to have a full hysterectomy. We'll remove your ovaries, your cervix and your womb. So you'll have your whole reproductive system removed. He said it's the only way the cancer can be stopped from spreading. So I was like, oh, okay. I was like, well, you know, what can I say? Just, you know, it's that or you die, isn't it? It's that or the cancer's going to spread and you risk the you know, dying. So we both just like, just do whatever you've got to do, whatever you've got to do. So he then booked me in 8 weeks later through the NHS because he was an NHS, and he was a private doctor, but also an NHS doctor. And the NHS pathway for cancer is the best. So I went back into the NHS system, luckily. And on the 8th of December, I had everything removed. And so that was, you know, I mean, I feel like the thing is, because I'm adopted, in my head, as soon as I found out that news, I've always wanted to adopt. I've always wanted to adopt. It's always been in my path that I would adopt. And because I'm adopted, I just thought I was going to go full circle, and that was in my path line. So as soon as I had that news, it was just, well, this is where I'm going to be. You know, this is what's going to happen. I was meant to adopt, and unfortunately, my health has directed me in that path that now I have no choice to.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just like, just, you know, this is just how it's meant to be. So, you know, you can get through this. It's only stage one. It'll be fine. So I'm not going to die. Let's do it. So, I don't want to think about all the things. I think it's probably I've blocked out all the thoughts of, oh, you can't have more children and all of those things, because I feel like, well, I can adopt, so I can have another child and I'm alive. So how lucky, you know, how lucky I am that I am alive and that I had the choice, because some people find out they have cancer and you've got 2 weeks to live.
Yeah, I know. And I think, you know, you're right. The big headlines are, you know, you have your family, you have your health.
Yeah.
You always knew those were the most precious things to you anyway.
And thank God I had the fibroids out. Like, my yeah. God, if I'd not gone and had those out, if I'd not gone and spent that initial money and gone private and done that,
yeah,
it would have been a different story if I'd waited 2 years on that NHS for the waiting list.
Oh, don't. That makes me shudder. I mean, the idea as well of going to hospital with bleeding and pain and something protruding from your body and then being like, well, that's kind of what happens, isn't it? Or that's a heavy period. Like, that actually makes me quite angry on your behalf, but I'm sure you don't need that from me. But I just feel like it's not you. I think you were. That's a real disservice, you know, to instincts that you had that were turned out to be spot on.
Yeah,
and thank goodness you got talked into going and seeing the other specialists who turned out to really know their stuff.
I think
that quickly.
Thank God I did. I'm so grateful for the surgeon. I'm grateful for Anita, the gynae geek, you know, for giving me the solid advice, like, do it, Dilly, don't not do it, do it. Go and see this person, go and do this. And for him going, because I was like, oh, well, I'm filming at the moment, so do you think I could wait till January or next year and do it? He's like, you need these fibroids out now. They're growing and they're growing big. And if you even want to contemplate having another child, have them out now. You know, forget about filming, forget about anything. This is your health, prioritise it. And I think that was a really big lesson for me, because I've always put my health to the side and just thought, work. Oh, I've got this, I've got that. But this really made me wake up and think, I need to do something. So, and then obviously having then found out, being told you've got cancer, was like, wow, I really now have to prioritise my health.
Yeah.
I had no choice, you know. So in December, when I had the second operation, they were filming a show, and obviously I had to miss that. But, you know, and that show came out last week. And for me, when it came out, I think I'd shared on my Instagram, you know, sort your life out, it's back this week. It's a bit bittersweet for me this week, because that was when I was in the most pain, because I actually woke up, obviously I'd had the first operation, so I'd had a myomectomy in October.
Which is a big operation, by the way.
Which is a C-section operation. I then had the next operation in December. The same, went through the same scar, but this time they were removing my entire reproductive system. But basically what happened was the cancer had spread. So the cancer had spread from my womb and it had spread to the lymph nodes that were around my pelvis. And the lymph nodes, I don't know if you know, but lymph nodes are only meant to be 1 to 2 centimetres or less. And if they're more than that, it's usually indicative of cancer. Mm-hmm. My lymph nodes had grown to the size of two man's fists. They were so full of cancer, and they'd wrapped themselves round the sciatic nerve to my leg. So basically, when they went in to give me the hysterectomy and everything else that goes with it, they had to scrape the lymph nodes off my sciatic nerve. So as you can imagine, your sciatic nerve is the second largest nerve in your body. And any damage to your sciatic nerve, anyone who's had sciatica, anyone who's had any sciatic damage will tell you it is the most excruciating pain. So I'd woken up from this surgery, not only having all of my reproductive system move, but this pain to my leg, my sciatic nerve, which the pain ended in my foot where all my nerve endings end. So I then couldn't walk for 4 months. And oh my God, I cannot tell you. I was on 16 painkillers a day. 8 of those were tramadol. So every single day for like 3 or 4 months, I was just in another world because it was so excruciating. I mean, I still have pain now in my foot. I can't be on it all day, or if I'm working all day, I have to put shoes on because there's, you know, if I'm in a lot of hard floored houses, so the pain in my foot goes, or, you know, it's the after effects of that surgery were huge. So it wasn't just emotional, no, it was physical. It was huge physical damage. And then, of course, I had to wait for the sciatic nerve and be able to walk again, and that damage to really sort of try and fix itself a little bit before I could then start radiation. So then I had 28 sessions of radiation, which finished 8 weeks ago. So, yeah, my body's been through quite a lot of trauma in the since October, really. And I suppose I don't think I've recovered from it, really, yet. I mean, I've recovered as much as I can physically, I think. I think mentally it'll probably be with me for years. But I just think the physical sides of it, like what my body has been through, has been a huge amount.
Yeah, and that will basically come up to the anniversary, I suppose, of the whole thing beginning.
Nearly a year, yeah.
Thank you for telling me all about it, and I'm so sorry you've had to go through so much. I feel like you've found yourself a member of lots of clubs you might not have really wanted to be a member of. I have spoken to someone else who had a radical hysterectomy, actually, with cancer, called Hannah Fry, and she spoke about it too. And I know that for her, it left her, this was a few years back, she had hers now.
Mm.
But she was contemplating another baby and all the similar things. Mm. And I think it's an enormous thing. And I hope you found lots of people that are giving you all the support you need. Because I think in those times, you must just need all those people around you. Because if you're dealing with physical pain, emotional pain, shock, that's a lot of things firing off at the same time.
Absolutely. No, I was just so lucky. I mean, I've always had an amazing support network around me. And, even with the TV family that I call them, you know, and my private family and friends, I was very lucky. I was so well supported because, you know, I'm not normally someone that asks anyone for anything, but it was just sort of, I couldn't do anything. I physically couldn't do anything. So I needed that help.
And you like to be busy, I get the impression. Yeah. You like doing what you do.
Oh my gosh, it's been so lovely to be back out working, back out filming and feeling like myself again. Yeah. You know, my career bring me so much joy, as do most people's. And I've always been very fortunate with that I absolutely love what I do, and that I love going into people's houses. I love sorting them out. I love what my career has brought me. In fact, that I do what I love now on TV. So for me to have been frozen for 4 months and not been able to do that was impossibly hard. But it's also just been great for me to be able to share that journey and talk and teach people about it. You know, I do something every week called a Sunday sermon.
Mm.
And one of the things I've added into that is prioritize your health. You know, go this Monday, get your checkup, go and get a second opinion, because I didn't do those things. And I think so many of us do put it off, especially, like you say, people that are busy, we're working mums, dads, whatever, we put our health to a side. And actually, you know, when you've got that feeling that something's not right, just keep on, because often or not, you know, we are right. You know, our instincts are right.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, I mean, I only mentioned Hannah, by the way, because I mean, I'm sure you know you're not alone, but I think sometimes when big things happen to us, it makes us feel like you've sort of fallen into some subcategory of where your life's supposed to be at that point. Because obviously it's meant things like menopause and things like this. Mm. Before you were expecting to deal with any of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I went straight into the menopause. I mean, I haven't even talked about that. I always forget, like, oh, God, yeah, I'm going through the menopause. Suddenly get a hot flash. I'm like, oh, yeah, that'd be the menopause. But it took me a long time to wean myself off all those drugs. So I still don't know what my body is recovering from. So whether now all the symptoms I get, are they the menopause? Are they this? Are they that? Are they the surgery? Are they... God, it's endless.
Yeah, and I guess... throughout your life, it sounds like you've sometimes had to deal with stuff that's very much not what you think you would want to be dealing with at that time. But a lot gets put on your shoulders.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that, unlike you when you're young, you now have your partner and your kid to kind of help you through the days.
Yeah, my goodness. I'm so lucky. I do you know what? It's, I mean, my husband, Charlie, was the best decision I ever made, you know, when I was 30. And I think, God, thank God I married a man like him, because I don't know what I'd have done without him in the last year. I mean, he's always been an amazing husband, but, you know, even this year he's just been like, oh, my God. So I'm very lucky. And, you know, and having a really strong daughter, you know, and I didn't tell her, by the way, you know, I didn't tell her until I started radiation.
How did you manage that?
I just told her that when I first had a problem with I first went into hospital for the fibroids. Said, oh, mummy's got an operation in her stomach, fine. Then when I found out I had cancer, I told her that the operation I had didn't go well, and now I've got to have my womb removed, which means I can't have any more babies. So I basically told her like that. Yeah. I thought, I don't need to tell her anything about cancer and scare her until I'm through it. And then I know that the radiation is just the final part of it, because obviously I won't be able to escape saying I'm going to hospital every day, consecutively, every week. So I just didn't want to put that on a nine-year-old, because I think maybe, like you said, maybe that was because I knew what pressure that was as a 10-year-old, seeing my mum in and out of psychiatric care and what that can do to someone. So I thought, if I can protect her as much as I can protect her, let me just tell her that I'm having an operation because my womb is damaged. So, and she said to me, oh, well, we can adopt if you can't have more children, can't we? Because she knows about adoption. She knows I'm adopted. So I was like, yeah, we can. So, and then when I told her eventually, when I finished all the treatment and I was recovered and about to start radiation, I then said, you know, mummy was celebrating yesterday, because when they told me, oh, you're cancer-free, there's no more cancer, you can now start your radiation. I then said, you know, why are we celebrating? Why are we drinking champagne? And, you know, why people keep coming around and hugging me. She's like, no. I said, well, because mummy had something called cancer, but now they've removed it. Now I'm starting radiation just to make sure that none of it's there anymore. And that's it. She's like, oh, okay, you're okay now though? I was like, yeah, I'm fine now. She's like, okay, good. And that was it. And then, you know, off she went. So I think I tried to limit that as much as I could, because I don't know, everyone's different. Like,
yeah,
I said,
everyone is different. Still, I'm very impressed with that.
Because that was a lot to hold for 4 months while I was, you know, recovering from these two major surgeries from the December to the, when I started radiation in May, you know, I think I started. So that was a lot to hold in myself. That's huge. You know, but I just didn't want her to be affected by it, and I didn't want her to carry anything on her shoulders, because I think you say that word amongst kids and you just, you know, she'd have gone into school and said, oh, my mum's got cancer. Someone would go, oh, my granny died of that yesterday. Yeah. Or my mum died of it, or my dad, you know, you just, kids say things without thinking, and then she would have been like, oh, and I didn't want her to overthink, to worry about something that was out of her control.
I think that's an amazing, I think you're absolutely right with that. I think sometimes, particularly when you have a child that seems very mature and together, and
yeah,
I mean, I think it's really easy to overshare with our kids. I've definitely had to apologise to my eldest for sometimes being like, sorry, I offloaded on you things that I wouldn't dream of telling his brothers. And I think, oh, golly, you know,
yeah,
and nothing distressing if anyone listening is worried, but just... it's just like an instinct you have sometimes, but I think...
Of course, and everyone's so different, but I'm just... I think maybe it's my own childhood things that I think, no, I'm not telling her. Let's just wait. Let's wait till I'm okay. It, you know, if it had been serious and I had to tell her, I would have told her.
Yeah, you wouldn't know if
I think parenting is so unique, isn't it? We all have our own ways of dealing with things because of things that we've been through or things that we know that we're in control of. And for me, I could control that, and I just didn't want to put it on her, you know. And that's why I didn't tell, you know, the people that follow me Instagram, I didn't tell them until I was through it, because I thought, I can't share anything about this until I've been through it myself, because A, I can't educate you about it, and B, I don't know myself. You know, this is so new to me, and also it's a lot for me. You know, it's a lot for me to deal with all of these things that are going on. So how can I deal with it when I, you know, and talk to you about it when I can't even deal with it myself? So it just had to be private until I was ready to go, this is what's been happening behind the scenes.
Well, I think actually that's obviously a very good instinct again of like how to protect yourself, because, you know, when you share things online, it invites all the dialogue, all the conversation. And sometimes people might have come up to you unfiltered in the street and just gone, oh, I can't believe they're going through that. And you might have been out with your daughter and you think, not here, not now. So it gave you a little autonomy on the information on a sort of need-to-know basis.
Absolutely. And I think it was very much a, I'm talking about it now. That's why, you know, I came on, I did a video and I did it with the gynecologist that I spoke to. So it came from an educated point of view as well, because I think, like you said, on social media, it's so easy to come out and blurb everything out and not know everything about it, not know what you're talking about. And then you get a million questions going, oh, but hold on, this is. And, you know, she gave the educated side of it. I gave the personal side of it.
Yeah.
And then I was like, this is the only time I'm talking about it. Life is carrying on as normal.
Yeah.
So sort of stop people calling me every day and or messaging me every day going, because I can't be, I couldn't be an advocate for it, because I just thought I don't want to be that person. You know, it's like I'm not suddenly going to change my page now and it's going to be all about cancer, because that's not my coping mechanism. You know,
that. It's
just I've been through it, I've done it. I'll educate you when I can. I'll talk about the menopause when I can. I'll talk about gynae cancers. I want to work with some gynae cancer charities. I'm an ambassador for Adoption UK. So let me do the positive things with it rather than let's all talk about my experience. You know, I'll talk about it when I can talk about it. But I think that's just the way I've had to cope with it. And I think it's been the right thing.
Yeah, and also sometimes things happen to you and you don't automatically have to turn it into, you know, fighting it for anybody else if you don't want to. Sometimes it's just a thing that happened and you have to be like the poster girl for it. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. And I just didn't want to be a poster girl for it. And for me, that was just the way I had to cope with it, because, you know, it's a lot, isn't it? It's a huge amount.
And also you've already experienced the things you did feel comfortable sharing, you know, the struggles you'd had with your mum, the struggles you'd have trying to have another baby.
Mm.
I do actually think the area of secondary infertility is a big deal, because I think people don't always, it's sort of treated in a different box to people who are just trying to have their first baby. But actually, as I understand it from my mum trying to have another baby after my sister, she said in some ways she found having trying to have another baby and not being able to really even more pain, which this is her words, not mine, I'm trying to upset anyone. She said she found it even more heightened sometimes because she knew all the things she was missing out on.
Yeah.
So she used to find that when people would be like, oh, well, you have other kids.
Mm.
Sometimes it kind of didn't really take into account that the fact that you knew what you were, as you say, what you were missing out on.
Exactly,
sometimes.
Yeah. I think it's something, again, that's not spoken about. But gynae cancers aren't spoken about much.
Mm.
You know, it's something that's still quite a grey area with the NHS, and it's something that, you know, isn't investigated enough. So I you know, I'm absolutely will want to be and have talking to charities about that, and I want to raise awareness for that, and I want more people to talk about it and get themselves checked out and not ignore the symptoms, which is why, you know, on my Sunday sermons I try and remind people, go and get yourself checked out. You know, whenever I see anything about gynae cancers, I share it, because it is so important, you know. So these things, you know, I've got a platform, I always want to try and use it for the good.
Well, I think that's brilliant. And I think what you said before about women sometimes putting their own health so way down on the list is a really big part of it. Plus, we're obviously introduced to the idea of, you know, pain every month, all this stuff is sort of part of a badge of like womanhood and the club we're all part of. But actually, that doesn't mean we should just, you know, put up with the things that can dog us for years and things that you just think that's not right. I think what's coming across in spades is that your instincts are very well honed in terms of like how you prioritize stuff and how you deal with things. Like, I think you've got a very clear sense of who you are and how you need to manage things to make you feel good about stuff. That's really impressive. May I just ask you one question about adoption?
Course.
Because I've got an adopted sister.
Amazing.
And I wondered what's something that you'd only understand about being adopted if it's happened to you. What's a good thing for me to know about how that feels?
I mean, my experience of adoption is amazing. And I just feel like I've always just thought how lucky I am. How lucky I am to have been found by a family that have embraced me and loved me and given me the most incredible start in life, and, you know, everything that they could have wanted. You know, even though my mum and dad, like I said, weren't there, I was never short of love. You know, when I was there, I was never short of love. My mum still now, obviously, you know, the fact she's at the bottom of my garden obviously means that we have a relationship. It's a functional relationship, but it's still a relationship. But I just feel very lucky. I mean, look at where I am today. despite everything that's happened, look at where I am today. You know, I'm thriving. You know, I'm successful. I'm happy. I'm loved. I love my job. I love my career. You know, I've got great friends and family. And that would not have been possible had I not been adopted into this country, had I not come over here. So I'm always grateful. I've always been someone that is very grateful for the life that I've got. I never dismiss anything or ever think that anything is just handed to me on a plate, which, you know, stems back to why Nelly is the way that she is. Because I think, God, how lucky you are to be here. You know, be grateful for the life that you've given, the hand that you've been given. And, you know, you can turn every negative into a positive as well. And even with having a cancer diagnosis, you know, I used it and thought, right, well, you know, now I can adopt. This is going to be the push I need to go and actually go and adopt. I can help other adopted children. You know, I can make other people, you know, learn about gynae cancers. And maybe if I can help one person go and get a checkup, which is going to stop them, you know, or get them seen, then, you know, I've helped other people. So I think if whatever you've got, whoever you are, is always to try and turn that around. But I just feel very grateful and very lucky and very loved. I think adoption is the most selfless thing that anyone can ever do. And I always, anyone that's in an adopted family, anyone that has adopted children, anyone that has is adopted themselves, I just think you have to be lucky. I think you should think you are very lucky. But I know not every adoption story is nice. And that makes me really sad. I think when I hear about people that feel rejected, that feel like they were rejected and unloved and all of those things, I think, oh my God, that must be awful, because I can't relate to any of that. You know, I feel so lucky, and I feel like we're in a special gang, and I love that.
Wow, that's so positive. I have to say, Dylan, I think you're such a force for good. And I know on Sort Your Life Out, you're just dealing with clutter, but I think it sounds like you're capable of sorting out a lot more than
that. Oh, thank you.
including the path your own life is on. So I wish you all the best with the adoption.
Thank you.
I'm thrilled you're thriving. I think yes. That's a really positive note to end on. And don't worry, the door has not been sealed. You are free to leave.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
See, what a woman. I mean, how much positivity. So impressive. I get the impression that Dilly is one of those people. I mean, obviously, she has her support network, her daughter, her husband, and that unit, and, you know, friends, family. So I think if you have that support, it gives you a good standing anyway. But I also get the impression that Dilly is one of those people who kind of picks, you know, decides how she's going to feel about things, and the positive, you know, glass half full attitude, and then lives it until she feels it. To be honest, I relate to that, because I feel like that about things, but I have not had to deal with the amount of things that Dilly has. And so I think she's a really impressive woman and really lovely. And I really appreciate her being so open about everything she's been through, because, you know, definitely not alone, but also not easy. So sending lots of love to her and to you, if you or anyone you know are affected by similar things. I hope you're feeling okay in yourself. Meanwhile here, oh, Saturday morning is in full swing. I've got kids all over the place, and I'm about to go, actually, which is always feels a bit weird on a Saturday. Tonight I have a gig with the band, so Richard will join me later. But for now, I'm actually off to go and sing for a TV programme celebrating 10 years of gay marriage in the UK. And I'm the wedding singer. So actually, I'm really proud to be a part of it. It's going to be lovely. And we've got a beautiful day. How lucky are we? I mean, it's the end of October and it's gorgeous outside. So I think I might be singing outside. But yeah, it'll be a really happy thing, I think. And then I've got tomorrow off. And like a true Brit and a nice enough day, Richard and I are going to have a barbecue. The last one of the year, possibly. I mean, We can now no longer refer to this as late summer. We are definitely in autumn. But wow, what a beautiful day. Golden light. Gorgeous. Oh, I'm being heckled from another room. Listen, it is the end of the series. But next week, there's a special bonus episode. This is really lovely, actually. So as you know, the podcast has been sponsored recently by Clarks. And they asked me to talk to my mum about our memories of shoe shopping. But of course, when you get me and my mum together,
You don't just talk about one thing. You talk about lots of things. And if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, then you might remember that my mum was one of my first guests in the first series. And I think still, obviously, not just because she's my mum, my favourite guest I've had, but also it was just such a significant conversation to have with my mother, you know, about how motherhood changed her. I think you always think of your mum as eternally having been a mum. And of course, they weren't. So yeah, lovely to record that. So you'll hear that next week. And then I've been busy already recording for the next series. Many more wonderful women coming your way. And in the meantime, listen, have an amazing autumn. I will see you. The new series will kick off sort of mid to late November, around the time I'm going on UK tour. If you're coming to see me on tour in the UK, I can't wait. I'm getting all Christmassy for that. I'm also going to Europe in the new year in spring. So bring in lots of disco dance your way. You know me, disco pop always has my heart. But with a little sprinkling of Christmas, if you're seeing me in November and December. I mean, if Christmas ain't ripe for a kitchen disco, I don't flipping know what is. I'm basically going on stage as human tinsel. Anyway, lots of love to you. Thank you so much for coming to listen to the podcast. Big love to Ella May, who does the amazing artwork, to Claire Jones, who's the most amazing producer and all-round cheerleader, to Richard for doing the editing. I am being shouted at by my four-year-old. To you for lending me your ears. Enjoy this lovely golden autumn that we're having, and I will see you soon. Lots of love. Bye. Coming, Mickey. What is it? I'm downstairs.
What?
Recording for the podcast. Come down.
Who are you talking to?
Well, at the moment it's just me, but hopefully at the other end of it there'll be someone listening.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.